This program is a production of the Reformed Forum, an organization devoted to producing and distributing Reformed theological content for a connected age. Online at reformedforum.org. This is Christ the Center, episode number 179. Today we speak with Dr. David Skeel about Christians in legal studies and the ethics of bankruptcy. Welcome to Christ the Center, Doctrine for Life, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 179, and my name is Camden Busey, and we have a very special program lined up for you today. We're going back to our discussion on law, and I have two very special guests with me today. We have James Sweet, who is the former chairman of Drinker, Biddle, and Reith, as well as presently being counsel and director of special projects at Westminster Theological Seminary. Welcome back, Jim. It's great to have you.
It's great to be here, Camden. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, absolutely. And thank you so much for introducing me to our guest and inviting him over. We're very pleased to welcome Dr. David Skeel to the program. He is the S. Samuel Arsht Professor of Corporate Law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. He's the author of several books I'll speak about in a moment, but I want to introduce him to you now and just welcome you to the program, David. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
We are really excited. It's going to be an interesting program today, one that I think is going to stretch our listeners and present them with some interesting topics and ways to think about Christians in the practice of law. We're not speaking law and gospel. I know that's always a confusion to people when they see our titles, Christians and Law. Today we're speaking about the practice of law. And not speaking about doing the law of Moses. But David is a well-recognized name in many circles. He's appeared on several programs, including the NewsHour, Nightline, Chris Matthews, Hardball, NPR, and Marketplace. NPR might put you on the outskirts of some of the conservatives.
Well, I like to NBC, cover all my bases.
MSNBC, yeah. At least you haven't been on the Rachel Maddow show yet, I don't believe.
I'm waiting for the call.
Waiting for the call. The New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, etc. He's also the author of several books, including The New Financial Deal, Understanding the Dodd-Frank Act and Its Unintended Consequences, Icarus in the Boardroom, as well as Debt's Dominion, A History of Bankruptcy Law in America. And that's really where we want to head with this discussion today. We're going to end up speaking about corporate and possibly municipal bankruptcies and the ethics involved in corporate entities and debt and defaulting on our debts and those sorts of things. It'll be a very fruitful topic, I expect. But Jim, I think I'll pass it to you first to maybe introduce David to our audience, and then we'll allow David to speak about his professional and theological background before we start up our topic today.
Great. Jim? Thanks, Camden. Dave, you and I met about 6 or 7 months ago when you were in the archives here, I think, at Westminster, doing some research down there. I think it would be interesting to our listeners and viewers to just get a little background from you, where you went to school, how you came to be a law professor, any practice that you did in the meantime, and perhaps what some of your professional interests are beyond bankruptcy law.
Okay, that's a tall order or a short order, I guess, depending on how I handle it. Just to give a 30-second CV of my life in the law, I went to law school at the University of Virginia, clerked for a federal judge in Wilmington, which is what brought me into the Philadelphia area. Practiced for 2 years at a firm downtown, not Drinker Biddle, Duane Morris and Heckscher, another fine Philadelphia
firm. We're going to have a
fist fight here. we all get along in Center City, Philadelphia lawyers. Practiced for 2 years and then went into teaching at that point. Taught for 8.5 years at Temple Law School and then moved across town to University of Pennsylvania's Law School. And I've been there for something like 12 and a half. This is the end of my 21st year of teaching. So how did I get into law teaching? I always have been an academic at heart. I was an English major as an undergraduate. For a while, I imagined becoming an English professor or a poetry professor or something like that, which is hard to imagine if you read any of my articles, probably. I actually didn't really think about becoming a law professor, but I enjoyed writing, and mm-hmm. I wrote an article in, I actually wrote it while I was in law school, finished it while I was practicing, and it became apparent to me I was not one of those people who could do everything, could be a practicing lawyer and write at the same time. And that if I wanted to write, I would need to move into a profession that would enable me to do that full time. And so that is what got me started thinking about teaching. And I've really never looked back. I've loved every minute of teaching. My core areas, as you alluded to at the outset, are bankruptcy and corporate law. But I also, in recent years, have written increasingly on topics relating to Christianity and mm-hmm. law, and that's how Jim found me in the library. I was researching J. Gresham Machen. I'm working my way through his archives mm-hmm. for a book I'm working on the Sermon on the Mount in American law, the relationship between a number of key figures' understanding of the Sermon on the Mount over the last 100 years wow. and the kinds of social campaigns they got involved in. So I think I answered most of Jim's question. Yeah. I'm not sure if I answered all of it.
Yeah, well, that's very interesting. And you're an elder, correct, at 10th Presbyterian Church?
I am indeed. Yeah. I came to Philadelphia thinking that I was just passing through 25 uh-huh. years ago, but got steered to 10th Presbyterian Church, met my wife there at an urban missions conference, actually that Tim Keller and Manny Ortiz were the headline speakers before, and fell in love with the city, with my wife, with 10th Presbyterian Church, and we have not looked back in that respect either.
That's fantastic. It's always great to hear those kinds of stories. And we're very thankful that there are people like you around, especially in our area. And that's one of the joys of being around Westminster. We get to meet a lot of interesting people that they gravitate to the seminary for one reason or the other. But it's fascinating to hear the things that you've been interested in and the things you've been working on. And I'm very excited to expose our listeners to some of that today. Now, you've written an article. Several years ago, entitled "The Unbearable Lightness of Christian Legal Scholarship," and was it several years ago? I didn't catch a date on it.
I can't even remember. I think it came out in 2008. Yeah. I probably wrote it in 2007.
Now it's fascinating to interface these things because we start to think about law in general and where law gets its foundations in a philosophical sense, and most basically we think about God ordaining governments to care for society and for his people. And there are all sorts of different philosophical things you could talk about in terms of how those governments should be organized and where they derive their authority from beyond the fact that it comes from God and what types of laws should be instituted, etc. But today we want to focus more or less on the Christian's influence in society and the practice of law as we have it today. We have a legal system. How do Christians go about interacting with it? Do we attempt to influence it? Do we keep ourselves locked up in a box and remain separate from the world? Or how do we go about these things? And this is what's really interesting in this article, The Unbearable Lightness of Christian Legal Scholarship. One thing you speak about is different cultural and ideological movements and that they can actually be traced in America's law reviews. How are you able to go do research upon these sorts of things? And it's almost sociological and cultural research, but you're doing it through the lens of American legal reviews. How is that actually the case?
Well, it absolutely was sociological. The way this started out was I had been struck that in my reading of the most prestigious law journals in this country, every law school has a law journal, and mm-hmm. typically the most prestigious law journals are the law journals at the most prestigious schools. I had been struck that there were so few articles that had any discernible Christian perspective in them. When you think about how central Christianity is to this country and to the evolution of this country, whatever you think about the founders and their religious views and the nature nature of that influence, it really was quite shocking to me that there was so little discussion of those kinds of issues in the major law reviews. And so I spent the better part of a summer in our University of Pennsylvania Law Library going through the table of contents of each of those reviews and looking to see evidence of Christian perspectives. And what I found was that for almost the entire 20th century, there was none. And so in a sense, what this article is an attempt to explain that anomaly. Why is it that you just don't see or didn't see? It's changed a little bit since then, although not a huge amount. Why don't you see Christian perspectives on the law? Why don't you see people wrestling through these issues from a Christian perspective and see that in the top law reviews?
Mm-hmm. You even bring up the point that 1976 was the year that Newsweek proclaimed as the year of the evangelical, but yet there is no corresponding influence, but yet you find a very specific trajectory in other fields, do you not, or other movements? Do you find that thread in law reviews?
The thread of an influence?
Yeah, non-Christian influences, is it very simple to find, or is it
elementary
to find those in law reviews?
The law reviews and legal scholarship is subject to the same kinds of trends that other disciplines are. And so in any given time, there is some ideological perspective that is particularly popular. So over the last 20 or 30 years, we've had feminist approaches to the law. We've had race-based approaches to the law. We've had deconstruction influence, literary theory influenced views of the law. We've had all kinds of isms in the law, but we haven't had Christianism in the law. And so it really was anomalous. We've gone through a period, a generation, where evangelical influence really, really, really increased. That's what Newsweek was getting at in 1976. That was relatively early in that development. But there wasn't a corresponding trend in the legal literature. Mm-hmm. And so, again, that was another one of the questions I was trying to wrestle with in that article. Why is that? Why while all of America is recognizing evangelicalism and its potential influence, why aren't law professors recognizing it?
Yeah. In one of those isms, if you will, was the critical legal studies notion which I think started up at Harvard, as I recall. Did it not?
It certainly was heavily centered at Harvard. I'm not sure if you would say it started, but Duncan Kennedy was one of the early advocates of that perspective, and he's long been a professor at Harvard.
Right, and it's still going on. It still suffuses the curriculum at some places, does it not? Or is that more tangential these days?
It's more tangential now. It has had an influence on legal scholarship. So you still see evidence of it. So one of the main tenets of this perspective on legal scholarship is law is really about power, and any law, even objective seeming laws, are really based in power. You see those kinds of ideas in lots of legal scholarship still, but as a movement, there are no longer lots of folks who would say, I am a critical legal studies adherent, in the way they might say, I'm an adherent of some other perspective.
Yeah. And just from my standpoint, as never being a teacher, but always being a practitioner, probably one of the answers is, I've got to get a job someday. And frankly, it doesn't sell well at a large firm. Yeah. It just doesn't.
Yeah. Certainly it's probably not a great idea to tell your partners that what they're doing is simply about power. It has no greater validity. Although in their defense, one of the arguments the critical legal studies folks often made was that they were there to subvert the system. So it was okay to get into the system and pretend like you're like everybody else, as long as you're subtly undermining the system.
That was the fascinating thing to me about Duncan Kennedy and the movement is, I'm really here to subvert it.
Yeah.
He made no bones about it.
Now, the interplay between philosophy and theology has always been interesting, even from a sociological perspective. And then we start to add the dimension of international relations, and you're finding continental philosophy making its way into theology, etc. There's typically, I couldn't give a hard number, but perhaps a 15-year delay between what we get over in the continent philosophically and what shows up in American theology. What kind of lag time is there between many of these philosophical, sociological, other types of movements? What kind of lag time is there between when they happen out there versus when they start to show up in law?
This is it's a great question, and I think the answer is it really depends on what mm-hmm. the movement is. So with continental philosophy, we've just, Jim and I have been talking about a movement in legal scholarship called critical legal studies, mm-hmm. yeah. which really is continental philosophy. It's Derrida, mm-hmm. Foucault brought to legal scholarship. There was a clear lag there. There was mm-hmm. I don't know the exact number of years, but probably 10 or 15 years between some of these ideas in the philosophical realm, on the one hand, and on the other hand, when they moved into the legal realm. Some other movements have gotten into law a little bit more quickly. I think it's fair to say feminism probably got into law almost as quickly as it got into other disciplines. There also are some movements that really began in the law. And I mean, one of the things about law is central to so many things in our yes, culture yeah. that it sometimes is the source of movements rather than just a recipient of movements. So it really varies, I mm-hmm. think, would be the answer. But when law is drawing on outside influences like philosophy, there often is a lag, mm-hmm. And it's often 10 or 15 years.
It's fascinating to see that the religious, or at least the Christian influence, not being present there, especially considering post 9/11 the tremendous interest in Sharia law in other countries. And I've heard several programs and news articles trying to discuss the relationship between religion and a legal system, and in Muslim and Islamic countries, often you find a very tight link or maybe even identity between a Sharia law, which comes directly from the Quran, and the civil governments that are established. Do we find any influence in the United States of other religions in these journals, or is it simply a lack of Christian influence or just religious influence altogether?
It's another good question, and it really kind of varies religion by religion. One of the interesting things about religious influence is at a time when religious influence is very great in our culture generally, it might not be that strong within the law, the legal scholarly world, mm-hmm. and vice versa. In some respects, I think Islam is an example of that. There is a growing literature on Islamic finance and Islamic rules about what kinds of financial transactions are okay, what types of banks are okay. That is very trendy in legal scholarship, and it's very well received in legal scholarship. At a time when that's a little more problematic in the culture at large. In some respects, Christianity is the opposite. Christianity is, as much as we like to think of ourselves as being victims and a minority in this country, and the country is no longer Christian, evangelicalism is politically very influential in this country.
Just read some articles on this today with Huckabee dropping out and Romney and all this. Everyone's talking about the evangelical influence, and it comes down to this. It is a massive power, for good or for ill.
Absolutely, and evangelicals are much less influential within mm-hmm. legal scholarship. And those two things may be related to each other. So Christian legal scholarship is not trendy in the way Islamic yeah. legal scholarship is trendy. There is a very vibrant Catholic legal scholarship literature, mm-hmm. although a lot of that is fostered in Catholic law schools and in Catholic law reviews. So you see it at places like Villanova and Notre Dame. Even Catholic legal scholarship is not rampant in the non-religious mainstream law reviews.
How many of the Supreme Court justices are Roman Catholic, and our Chief Justices?
I should know.
Tremendous number. It's six.
I think. It's six, yeah. I think it's six Catholic, three Jewish.
Three Jews.
I believe
that's
is.
Right.
Wow. I had no idea it was that many.
You, oh, it's dramatic.
Yeah. Ask us who they are, and we'll see if Jim and I could come up with...
Oh, of course we can. We'll start right with John Roberts. And
okay, Roberts,
Scalia,
Alito.
Alito, Scalia, Kennedy.
Kennedy.
Of course is, as is John Paul Stevens.
Well, except Stevens is not
Stevens
in the court.
Stevens is...
But Sotomayor.
Sotomayor is Catholic, correct.
And we're missing...
We're missing one Catholic.
So it's...
Find
the Catholic.
Thomas. Yeah, Clarence Thomas.
Clarence Thomas. Really?
And then we have three Jewish members. Yeah, it's really remarkable that there is no Protestant currently.
It is.
Actually, John Paul Stevens was a Protestant.
He was the last one.
I might be jumping the gun here, but I wanted to ask you what the reason for this might be, and then remind me to maybe possibly connect this back to Roman Catholics' higher education. But what is the reason that you come up with why there is such a lack of Christian influence in legal studies?
I don't think there is a simple reason. There are several possible explanations. I actually, when John Paul Stevens stepped down last summer, a year or so ago, I was doing a little research on this, on law schools and religious orientation within law schools. One reason, I think, is the kind of things that I talk about in the article that we've been referring to, and that is that evangelicals just were not a prominent presence in major law schools. And we have a long tradition of kind of an ambivalent stance towards intellectualism. Evangelicals, until pretty recently, were often relatively hostile to the intellectual life. This is something Mark Knoll famously wrote about in The Scandal of the Evangelical Mind. And I think that's part of it. We don't have a tradition of fostering evangelical intellectuals. Mm-hmm. I think that's part of it. I think Catholicism does have a tradition of strong intellectualism. So I think that's a part of it. It's also the case that a number of particularly the theologically conservative Catholics on the Supreme Court have views very similar to a theologically conservative evangelical. And so when we say there's no evangelical on the Supreme Court, in some respects that's misleading. If you ask the question, what would an evangelical justice do that's different from what some of these other justices do, I think the answer is it's not clear. So those are some reasons. Jim, can you think of...
Well, it's an interesting phenomenon all across the academy, as you say. It's not just law school. It's all across the academy. And the article by Knoll was really, I think, a watershed article. What was it, 15, 20 years ago?
I think it was 94 because he did a 10-year look back at the art. It was 94, about 94.
But I remember reading it and thinking, you know, he's right. It's absolutely true. There was a certain predominance of not being able to, or not being willing or able to explain your faith, for example. Just, it's a faith. Mm-hmm. And Mark, I think, kind of burst the doors open and said, we can explain. We do have something to say. And I think guys like Tim Keller have been really helpful in that movement, too, because Tim comes at it from a very rational perspective.
Yeah, and I think it is the case that most of the tendencies that Mark Knoll pointed to, the anti-intellectualism, are either gone or on their way out in evangelicals. I may be optimistic about that, but there's not the same hostility that there was. And this is a trend that goes back a long ways. This is another thing I talk about a little bit in the article. I think you can trace this back to people like Francis Schaeffer. Whatever you think of Francis Schaeffer, he was saying, we need Christian lawyers and doctors. We need Christians engaged with the culture. Mm-hmm. And I think we're now seeing the fruit of that.
And I think that's exactly right, David. That he was really the forerunner of that movement. And it was Escape from Reason that he published back in the late 60s that was the beginning of that movement. Mm. Interesting sidelight. Just before he published Escape from Reason, he delivered the lectures at Wheaton College, where I was a junior at the time. And Mark Knoll was a sophomore. I remember sitting with Mark. Mark understood it, and I'm kind of scratching my head saying, what is this guy talking about? But Mark and I were pretty good friends, and Mark fully understood what was going on, and I'm saying, I don't get this. But that was – then he went and he wrote Escape – finished Escape from Reason. But that was really the beginning of that let's not be anti-intellectuals.
Oh, absolutely. I mean –
And he was a strange man, by the way. Oh, Francis Schaeffer was – a little different. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said that. But he was. He was a little different.
Maybe scratch that.
Well, that's off the record. If you wear lederhosen, you know, something's going on.
He didn't wear a lederhosen at Wheaton in 65, but he was. It was a fascinating week of lectures. But I'll tell you, I walked away thinking I may have gotten 10% of it.
Yeah. Well, the fact that there is such a lack of maybe a Protestant or evangelical influence in higher education, but yet we have very many prominent Roman Catholic schools, especially Jesuit schools, which have the Jesuits have had a rich tradition of rigorous intellectual thought and practice. Do you see any connection there between the influence on our Supreme Court and the fact that the Roman Catholics have had a good hold on higher education for so many years?
Well, I do. I think this is all connected to the extent to which the intellectual life and intellectual thought is valued within Catholicism and has been valued for centuries within Catholicism. And so I do think that's a part, that intellectual achievement is something to be aspired to within Catholicism. That has not always been the case within evangelicalism. I think that's part of it. There probably are United States-specific factors. Until relatively recently, Protestantism was the same thing as being American. And so there was a little bit of if one was Catholic, you felt like you were within an enclave, and that might have led you to push even harder in areas like the intellectual life and in my context, legal academia.
Mm. You also speak a little bit about some exceptions to this general rule. And the fact that you do find some material on church and state issues, the Catholic natural law tradition, and some other type of topics. Were there any particular reasons why those issues might have gotten through the sieve, as it were, or somehow? Or?
Well, the big exception to evangelicals not focusing on legal issues from an explicitly Christian perspective, obviously, was church-state. And the obvious reason for that is that's been a fraught issue in the United States since the beginning and has been central to what we're about. We've had this tension between not wanting religious influence on the direct religious influence on the government on the one hand, but being a very, very religious nation on the other. And there's just been ongoing frictions as a result of that. And I think it was inevitable that people would write about that, both Christians and non-Christians. So if you were a young Christian scholar and you wanted to do something that was connected to your faith, a safe place to do it would be the First Amendment, church, state kinds of issues. That's really the big exception. There were, even before the last few years, a few other exceptions, but they were much smaller enclaves within legal scholarship. I talk about legal history, which really in many respects connects up to the church-state writings. Also, lawyers' ethics and professional responsibility kinds of concerns. People were writing about those from a Christian perspective as well. But what you didn't see was people writing about economic issues, writing about the kinds of things that I write about, bankruptcy, corporate law, social issues. You really didn't see those being dealt with from a Christian perspective, again, in the top law reviews. This is not saying nobody is talking about these things, but Christians' perspectives on these issues are not in the conversation in top law schools, or were not until quite recently.
How much of maybe if I were to take the position of a skeptic or a cynic, how much of this would
rather
have to
you
do with
than me?
How much of this might have to do with the referee? I assume many of these journals are blind reviewed, and either have an editor or you have referees. How much of this might be? Might be at stake where they're not just interested.
I think that's another piece of it. I think there are kind of two sides to the coin. One side is evangelicals have had an ambivalent stance towards the intellectual life. That's one side. So we weren't pushing to get in to those leading journals to be part of the conversation. On the one hand, on the other hand, the folks who were gatekeepers for those journals were not especially sympathetic to Christianity. It wasn't always overt hostility.
Right.
A lot of times it was just a sense that Christianity is not relevant. This has nothing to do with what we're trying to do. At times it was overt hostility as well. But when you put those two things together, you get a world where there's not a very welcoming reception to Christian perspectives. And I do think that is part of the story. It's a two-sided story, not a one-sided story.
Yeah, certainly. What's the general climate now? I mean, have things changed, and what has been your experience being a Christian thinker who's teaching at UPenn, an Ivy League school, as well as publishing and being influential in the culture? What's it like today?
In a way, I'll give two different answers to that question. Mm-hmm. One version of the question would be, is it difficult to be a Christian in the law school world? And the answer is no, that the law school world of 2011 is a world that deeply values diversity and really is serious about that valuing of diversity. And as an evangelical Christian, in the law school world, I'm diversity. I'm not diverse in any other way, but in the law school world, I am something unusual.
Or at least very small minority.
Yeah, at least relatively uncommon. So from that perspective, it's not difficult to be a Christian in the law school world. If the question is, if I write an article that is a Christian perspective on bankruptcy or a Christian perspective on corporate law, am I going to get a welcoming reception in the leading law journals in 2011? Not necessarily, I think, is the answer. I don't think those limitations or those assumptions that we've seen for the last century in the legal journal world have disappeared altogether. So in terms of, do you see lots of articles of the type I'm talking about in the leading law journals now? Mm. No. I mean, you see a few more than you would have seen 15 or 20 years ago, but you still don't see a lot. So from that perspective, the world has not been transformed. Where I am more encouraged, and really am encouraged, is looking out at young, talented legal scholars who are thinking about becoming law professors. And as I look out on that group of people, I see far more evangelicals than I would have 5 or 10 years ago. There's a whole crop of evangelical young professors, professor wannabes, and they won't all be writing articles called Christianity and Bankruptcy or Christian Perspective on Bankruptcy. They might be writing just about bankruptcy or about corporate law or about constitutional law, but they are Christians whose faith is central to what they're doing who are going to be writing about these issues, and I see more of them than I did in the past. So from that perspective, the trajectory, I think, is encouraging.
Have you seen a similar thing, Jim, just in your experiences?
Well, interesting, because I shameless plug coming up. I showed David an article in the Yale Law Journal. A note.
I was thinking about this.
A note in the Yale Law Journal just
by a promising,
very, very promising. Comes from a fine heritage.
And he's also very good looking. I haven't met him yet, but I just know.
And it was a note in 2005, I think, or maybe 2003 in the Yale Law Journal, which is, of course, one of the most prominent journals. And it was essentially it wasn't phrased this way, but it was sort of a Christian's view of legal ethics. You could probably describe it much better than I could, and I don't want to do a shameless plug anyway.
Well, the article is, I believe, I've read it, though I've kind of skimmed it. I've not yet read it closely, but it's a Trinitarian perspective on legal ethics.
Wow.
And it was written by somebody Jim knows relatively well, his son. And as he said, it's in the Yale Law Journal, which is the top of the top in the law journal world. It's sort of hard to imagine 20 years ago an article that is so on its face explicitly Christian being in a law journal like that, but there it is. And I think that it's one data point, but I think it is reflective of a growing willingness to consider these kinds of perspectives and really to complete the job of diversity within the legal world, to bring in a perspective that has not really been fully brought in, ironically enough, given that it's so common in America more broadly.
And I think one of the reasons that was probably published is it was so far out. It was so novel. It was so novel that it caught somebody's interest.
Yeah. Well, that's possible. And who knows what the genealogy? I mean, it may be. Yeah, who knows what it is that caused it to catch somebody's eye?
But this raises a slightly different issue, Camden. But mm-hmm. I think it's an interesting one, and that is that your friend Bill Stuntz wrote this wonderful little piece called "Faculty Clubs and Church Pews." A few years ago, and it really, the bottom line is, Bill's view was that there's less of a gulf between the two, the faculty clubs, particularly in the institutions like Bill and David taught in, and the evangelical church pews, and that there's a lot of dialogue that could be occurring.
That's absolutely right. It was essentially an op-ed that he wrote 6 or 7 years ago, roughly 2005, I think. It was written for a web publication, and it went viral when mm-hmm. it came out, and it became so widely passed around that it landed on David Brooks's desk, and David Brooks named it one of the most influential, valuable essays of the year. I think it was 2005 in a mm-hmm. column in the New York Times, and the kind of argument Bill was making was that we law professors and we evangelical Christians have very similar values in many respects. We care about thought. We care about, in the same way that Christians care about the authority of the Bible, law professors care about the language of the law and the effects of the language of the law. And that this intuitive hostility we often have to one another, evangelicals on the one hand, law professors on the other, really doesn't make that much sense. And Bill, who I can't remember if we've mentioned it, Bill died a couple mm-hmm. of months ago mm-hmm. After 3 years of colon cancer. Bill really made it his life's mission in many respects to help bridge these two communities, to be a Christian witness in the Harvard Law School faculty lounge, but also to show his fellow evangelicals that that law professors are good people, not using that in a salvation kind of sense, but that they're made in the image of God in the same way that evangelicals are, and there's room for the community, for communities that include both.
Yeah, all of these things are very fascinating to talk about. All of these trends and speaking about the brighter future of Christians and particularly evangelicals in the legal community, and that brings us, I think, to a specific example we can spend most of the rest of our time on. You mentioned often throughout the discussion your work in corporate law and also bankruptcy law. And this has been a hot topic of the last several years. I believe a little while ago you wrote a piece in the Weekly Standard arguing for a way for states to be able to go bankrupt. And we've been talking about...
a very popular piece. So let me tell you.
California, anybody? California, anybody? We start talking about bailouts and over the last several years of the financial crisis, and it generates all sorts of ethical questions of what are the ethics of debt and bankruptcy and obligations that we have to others. And I think things just get magnified and complicated when we start to speak about corporate entities. Can you talk a little about corporations in general and how they're viewed in the legal system? And I'm familiar in some of my training that corporations are treated as people. And what are some of the dimensions that we must encounter when we start to speak about the legal system as it pertains to corporate entities?
Well, just picking a piece of your question, because there are lots of questions buried in there.
Courses and courses on that subject.
Well, in courses and courses, you could have courses and courses on the subject of to what extent is a corporation a person.
Yeah.
There is a centuries-long debate about the personhood or non-personhood of corporations. This goes into German philosophical theory.
Which Locke, is written
absolutely,
tons
and you probably know a lot more about that than I do. Fortunately for me, as a non-philosophy type, in American legal academic circles, that whole literature was thrown out the window in the 1920s and 1930s. The American philosophical pragmatists, people like John Dewey, no friend of Christianity, said that's just a bunch of hokum, and we'll look at pragmatically what the significance of a corporation is and not worry about whether it really has a mind of its own and is an entity of its own. But we still do wrestle with this question of to what extent are corporations like people and to what extent are they not? And one of the places where it's a very hot issue in American culture right now is in campaign finance. There was a very controversial Supreme Court decision called Citizens United a few months ago that essentially says for First Amendment purposes, a corporation is a person, and corporations should be able to contribute to political campaigns in the same way people do. So there's this an ongoing debate as to when should and shouldn't a corporation be treated as a person? What kinds of rights should they have? They do have free speech rights. Should they also have due process rights? And generally, they do have due process rights. And when do those analogies break off?
Or even in intellectual property. Jim, you've been working on that a lot lately in certain fields, but you end up with people, you know, a corporation who's treated as a person who owns a piece of intellectual property, but yet this, for all intents and purposes, this person cannot die unless, you know, unless there's a bankruptcy. But even now, the bankruptcy, and you just restructure or you kill them off, but right before you kill off the corporation, you sell all the property to somebody else, and you end up with corporations like Disney, who own Mickey Mouse, and, you know, they're going to own that forever or lobby to get the things extended. So there's all sorts of interesting
things. Well, as David probably knows, there's a couple of estates across the country that do nothing but litigate. They own intellectual property. The inventor's been dead for years, and all they do is litigate and settle, litigate and settle, litigate and settle. And the lawyers make a tremendous amount of money because you get your demand letter, and I've gotten them. I mean, my clients have gotten them. Get your demand letter, and you say, wow, they want $10,000. It'll cost $100,000 to defend. Send them a check.
Yeah.
Right?
Wow,
what a racket! It's an incredible racket.
So, especially in the tech industry, there's a lot of these, industry. And they just battle each other.
Yeah, early inventions too. I mean, the one I was dealing with for years was the guy that developed the little switch that when you opened the car door, the light went on.
Yeah. That's interesting.
Oh yeah, he's just made $1 trillion off it. Or I mean, he's been dead for 50 years, but his estate's made $1 trillion. But I think coming back to this whole notion of bankruptcy is important.
Right, exactly.
Final minutes, because David, the whole issue with states being in the trouble with they're in today, and of course California is in all things is probably ahead of the pack, and with Governor Brown, it may or may not there may or may not be some relief there. But what's your view on the options open to a state in terms of bankruptcy? We know that the municipalities have and will continue to, but it's a big jump from municipalities to states. And what are the issues there, and what's your thinking?
Great question. I'm going to jump back a step before I come to it and just reinforce Jim's point that municipalities and states are very complicated when you start thinking about it. I mean, the first question a lot of people have is bankruptcy ethical? Is it ever okay even for a person to file for bankruptcy? And they're good or – I mean, it's a hard question from a scriptural perspective. And the reason I think it's hard is because bankruptcy involves a tension between two clear scriptural dimensions of scripture. One is make your yes be yes and your no be no, that when you commit to repay an obligation, you ought to repay it. That's one clear principle in scripture. But another clear principle in scripture is the principle of forgiveness. The whole story of of salvation is a story that is analogized to freedom from debt, from being released from debt. I believe that Christ is using the debt example metaphorically, but it's also used literally in Scripture. And
in Jubilee.
And the Jubilee, absolutely, sure. Is a release from debts. And so you have these two things that are in tension with each other. And I think what that suggests is that you should never file for bankruptcy quickly, because you have that obligation to make good on your promises on the one hand. But on the other hand, I think bankruptcy is appropriate. And I actually think our bankruptcy system in this country generally is very biblical. It's very different from bankruptcy in many countries. It is a much more forgiving bankruptcy system. And I really think you can debate about it. It's not crystal clear. But I think our approach to bankruptcy, the idea that you ought to have an opportunity for forgiveness from debt if there's no way you can pay your debts back, if you're overwhelmed, is fully consistent with Scripture. When you go from that, you have to take one step to get to a corporation, and I'll skip that step, at least for now, in the interest of time. But you have to take another huge step when you move beyond a person, beyond a corporation, and you start asking the question whether a city or a state should file for bankruptcy. And I just think this is a really, really hard question. Where the law is now is we have a part of the bankruptcy laws allow cities and counties and other municipalities to file for bankruptcy. We have bankruptcy provisions for them, as long as their state lets them file for bankruptcy. Some states don't let their cities file for bankruptcy. And I'm working on the exact numbers. I think it's roughly half and half, the states that do. California does allow its cities to file for bankruptcy. If I remember correctly, Illinois, one of the other really troubled states, does not allow
it. That's my home. Jim, you and I, cause this?
So, we caused it. Our fault.
We're not paying taxes there anymore. Maybe that's the problem.
Anyway. So we've crossed the bridge with cities. We crossed it during the New Deal. What I suggested in this Weekly Standard article back in the fall, and also in a little piece in the Wall Street Journal a month or so after that, was we ought to think about letting states file for bankruptcy, adopting a similar set of rules for states. This is a very controversial idea. I have gotten a lot of pushback. I was just at a conference on Friday where there were about five of us talking about this idea. One of us was in favor of it, and four of us were against it. It was me against everybody else on the panel. It's a hard call. States are not like people, and there are other options. My argument for allowing states to file for bankruptcy, or at least thinking about it, is the alternatives. Hopefully no state would ever need to file for bankruptcy. And I think there's no reason to believe, even right now, that in the near term any of these states is going to collapse. But if things were to spiral out of control in California or Illinois or even in Pennsylvania, currently we have two options. The two options are the federal government bails them out. That's option number one. Option number two is they just default. They just simply don't pay. And my argument is, in that world, the worst possible world where everything is falling apart, having a restructuring mechanism is probably superior to either of those options. A flat-out default would be enormously disruptive. A federal bailout brings with it all kinds of problems. It distorts the markets in all kinds of ways. And at this point in our history, it's not clear whether the federal government could bail out a California or in Illinois.
Yeah.
So that's my argument. I try not to be too aggressive about making it, because I think reasonable minds can differ. And by the time you move from, is it okay for a person to file for bankruptcy, to a state, is it okay for a state to file for bankruptcy, you've traveled a long distance. And there are lots of differences that might lead one to conclude that bankruptcy isn't a good idea.
Dave, your approach there is very practical. The question is, do you think that there are any ethical issues involved when you go from person, as we talked about earlier, and the issues, the biblical principles there, to a state or a municipality. Are there any ethical issues, or are there not?
I think there might. I mean, depending on exactly what you mean, how you're defining ethical. But one thing that people think about a lot is the sovereignty of a state. And I'm not sure if this is what you have in mind, but the fact that in this country, states are in some respects like little independent sovereigns. And to have the federal government setting up a system where a state could file for bankruptcy strikes some people as inconsistent with that. Although one of the things that I hasten to add very quickly is what I have in mind would be a system where the state itself would invoke the bankruptcy law. Nobody could throw the state in into bankruptcy. And I think to be constitutional, that would have to
strictly
be
voluntary, no involuntary.
Absolutely, strictly voluntary. On the ethical, from an ethical perspective, I actually am inclined to sort of flip people's intuitions on their head. I think some people might say this is terrible for a state to renege on its obligations. It's unethical. The way I look at it is, what happens without bankruptcy? What if you don't have bankruptcy, you're in financial trouble, what happens? Well, what we've seen happen so far, at least in the last year or so, is that the pain tends to get visited on one or two constituencies on the state, where the target of all the cutting right now has been services for the poor and public employees and public employee unions. One argument for bankruptcy, in my view, is that in bankruptcy, you're much more likely to distribute the sacrifice. So it's not just a couple of people who are going to suffer. It's everybody who is going to suffer, or it's more likely that everybody will suffer. So people's intuition is bankruptcy would be completely unethical. I like to try to flip that on its head and say, the way you deal with the pain might look more biblical in bankruptcy than it looks outside of bankruptcy. And there aren't too many biblical passages that say, when we're in trouble, let's sock it to the poor and not worry about everybody else. I wanted to throw something in here that'd be a little controversial for some of our listeners. But I think you have to take those kinds of ethical considerations into account as well as the ones that might come to mind first.
I think, at least in my mind, and I'm sure other people may be having the questions as well, we start to perhaps bankruptcy isn't the right paradigm at a national level, but at least the ethical issue still comes into play. At what transformations are there when we start asking the question of the national debt, when the nation derives its power and legal personality from its people, but yet it owes its own people?
It's another great question. And a Recursive. Short answer to that, which we could probably go into lots more detail on, there's a pretty good argument that what you're doing when you're building up the national debt is taking away from future generations for the benefit of current generations. So there's a real question of what economists call intergenerational equity. Is it fair for us to be borrowing huge amounts of money now when that money is going to have to be repaid by our children or our children's children? And I think that raises ethical issues. I think the debt crisis that we have as a nation raises all kinds of ethical issues in a lot of different dimensions. That's one temporal dimension of it. Mm-hmm, I think it raises current issues as well.
Jim, I mean, do you have any further questions on this? I could go in any number of directions. I know we don't have a ton of time, but I'd like to give you the opportunity.
David, did you write anything about the restructuring of Chrysler and GM? And because you know, frankly,
what about DeLorean?
As a layman, I was offended because I thought it was obviously a cram down, and it didn't. The folks that were supposed to get it under the bankruptcy rules didn't get it, right? I mean, that's basically what happened.
I couldn't agree with you, boy. I thought this was a setup.
I don't mean to set you up.
When Star said, did you write anything about the Chrysler bankruptcy? I thought he knew the answer to that question.
No, I don't know.
And the answer to that question is, yes, I did write something about the Chrysler bankruptcy. And I was deeply disturbed by the Chrysler bankruptcy.
Why don't you just give 30 seconds for our listeners and what it was so they can understand what offended you and me, I guess. So, I didn't know this, by by the way, yeah. but I figured it.
No,
you,
this is
you
it. It's fascinating.
Yeah, I did write about it with a co-author, a bankruptcy scholar, or really a corporate scholar who also is a bankruptcy scholar named Mark Rowe. We wrote an article called Assessing the Chrysler Bankruptcy. And our view of what happened with Chrysler was what the government did in Chrysler was use bankruptcy to bail out Chrysler. Mm-hmm. And the government essentially decided who was going to get what in the bankruptcy. And it sure looked, you can't demonstrate this conclusively, but it sure looked like the senior creditors were getting ripped off in order to protect the unions and to ultimately to protect current suppliers of Chrysler. That basically what the government did, it looks like did not give senior creditors the treatment that they were legally entitled to. Now, the case is a little more complicated than this, and we make a complicated argument in the article, but it's quite clear that the government rigged the Chrysler bankruptcy, and it's really hard. It's at best debatable whether this was fair to all the claimants. So that's worrisome. The other thing that worried me about the Chrysler bankruptcy is nowhere did the government say, this is a really special situation. We've got to do it here. This is a terrible thing to do with the bankruptcy system. We really ought to allow the rule of law to run its course, but we can't do that here because Detroit is important, the car industry is important, but nobody ever said that. What everybody said was, we're just using normal bankruptcy rules. My concern is that somebody else is going to come along and play the kinds of games that the government played in Chrysler. Footnote on this, there was a Paul Krugman, the New York Times columnist, wrote a column this morning where he made the comment. This was not the heart of the column, but part of the column says, what the government did in Chrysler and General Motors is looking awfully good, right? You know, that it actually was, it really was a great thing they did. What he doesn't say in the article is what would have happened if the government hadn't rigged the bankruptcy system. And I think if the government had just allowed the bankruptcy system to run its course, General Motors would have been reorganized. Mm-hmm. General Motors would be fine today. Mm-hmm. And I think we wouldn't be worried about the effects of the General Motors bailout. A little more debatable with Chrysler, what would have happened with Chrysler. But the idea that this was just a great thing, I think, is a really misunderstanding of what happened with the car bailouts.
And I think part of the other offense, at least to me, was it was clearly favored constituencies that made out well. And the general public, Joe Bondholder, me, didn't make out well.
Oh, absolutely.
And it was the favored constituencies plus the not making the special case, I think. I mean, I guess you go all the way back to, you know, why not Lehman? And why Bear and not Lehman? I don't know.
Which is another set of, there's another set of issues in there. Right, but I do think that the car bankruptcies were deeply problematic. And what we can hope for is, first of all, that the car companies continue their upward trajectory, that at least at the moment they seem to have. And that this not affect the way bankruptcy is used in the future. If this became a pattern in bankruptcy, I think it would do real damage to the rule of law.
Yeah, I agree. Well, David, Dr. Skeel, I should say, this has been a fantastic discussion, and I want to thank you and Jim as well for joining us. I wish we could go on and on. I'm sure perhaps we could set something up in the future to plumb some more of these depths, but thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's always fun to sit in a room with y'all.
Great
fun.
This has been great. I'm sure our listeners are going to be excited. For people who are interested in reading more or finding out more, David does have some audio resources on sermonaudio.com through 10th Presbyterian Church. All these links I'll put in the show notes, the post at the Weekly Standard, as well as a blog, leslease.com. Could you describe that in just a few minutes and
certainly
let people know some of the history?
The blog is called
there?
Less Than the Least. It's a blog that I started with my friend Bill Stuntz 3 years ago, right after he got his cancer diagnosis. And It's kind of a slow moving blog.
yes, it is.
It's never. It's really moving slow right at this particular moment.
But it's rich. I mean, you're not just speaking about what you eat for breakfast. I mean, there's substance here.
We try to use some discretion. we hoped that that we wouldn't just tell you how we felt in a particular day. And so we, in a typical week, there would be two or three posts. Yeah. Bill passed away, as I've already mentioned, a couple of months ago. Yeah. So I'm not sure whether I will continue the blog after this year, but I certainly will continue it through this year. And we have posts on everything from legal issues to issues involving evangelicals to politics, you name it. Mm.
And let me add, as a reader of that, go back and read the last six or seven entries back to the one you made shortly after Bill's death, and there's a lot of resources in there, links to this fellow Bill Stuntz, who I had met a couple of times, but I certainly didn't know well, but he was a remarkable guy, probably the leading criminal procedure expert in the United States, wrote widely and was somewhat controversial in some things, just like David is, and but some truly wonderful resources there on his life. And I think you ought to put up the faculty club and church pew. You ought to link that.
Yeah, yeah. That's a good idea.
Well. I mean, Judge Dalzell, I think I told you Judge Dalzell mentioned that to me when I had lunch with him the other day. He thought that was just the most remarkable piece.
It is a remarkable piece. And Bill was famous is not too strong a word. Well, famous, full stop, but famous for his humility. And people, when they met and got to know Bill, they really saw Christ in a way that ought to be true in all of our lives. It's not true, I know, in my life the way it should be, but he really did model humility and really taking to heart the idea that we're all made in the image of God and we should treat one another with knowledge of that fact in mind.
And he was remarkably popular at Harvard Law School.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, Elena Kagan loved him.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. He was universal.
The new Supreme Court justice, who was dean at the Harvard Law School at the time he was there, and I've read some things that she just really admired.
Oh, they were very, very close.
Yeah. So that's the old we can get along, even though Elena Kagan's probably as liberal as they come, and of course Bill Stuntz probably was not.
Yeah.
But anyway, it's a very interesting article.
Yeah, there's some hope here, and it's fascinating to hear and to turn our listeners' attention to a new subject. And again, I want to thank you for joining me and taking the time to help instruct us and whet the appetite of many of our listeners. You can find all this information. I'll put in the show notes the links to these different resources. But, of course, our website is reformedforum.org, and there you'll find information about all of our programs as well as news and info about current events and things that are going on in the Reformed world. So visit us online at reformedforum.org as well as on Twitter at Reformed Forum. We want to thank everybody for listening, and we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.